The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the world's toughest biological material. What is that, Dave?
It is spider silk, Rob, specifically silk that comes from a spider known as the Darwin's bark spider, which hails from Madagascar.
And how do scientists know that this is the toughest biological material?
Well, Rob, first, we should probably explain what we mean by tough. That's a word that gets thrown around a lot in our popular discourse. But actually, for scientists, tough has a very specific meaning. Tough means a material that's not only strong, but also very elastic. And the reason they know this spider silk is the world's toughest biomaterial is that they did a lot of searching. There are actually over 40,000 species of spiders in the world, but scientists have only looked at the silk of about 100. And the reason they keep on looking at spider silk is because we know already that spider silk is extremely strong. Most of the silk that's been tested so far is tougher than Kevlar. So if you're looking for a tough material, you're going to look at spider silk. But these researchers want to find something that could be used for a range of applications, whether you're talking about bulletproof vests or any other tough, lightweight material. And the reason they focused on this particular spider, the Darwin's bark spider, is because it weaves its webs in very interesting places. It doesn't just pick a corner of a door or a forest or something like that and weave a web. It weaves these webs between trees that are swaying in the wind and weaves webs very close to the surface of the water, say in a river. Very hostile conditions where the web not only has to be really strong, but very elastic, very flexible, especially if one end's attached to a swinging tree, another end's attached to another swinging tree. You can imagine this has to be very tough material.
And so even though scientists haven't tested all 40 plus thousand varieties of spider silk, they're convinced that this is the toughest one?
Well, this is the toughest one they've seen so far. In terms of strength, it was near the top. But what really put it over the edge was its elasticity. It was twice as elastic as any other known spider silk. And when you factor that in, you've got a material that's far stronger. And what they say is the strongest biomaterial or biological material yet discovered.
And you said it's tougher than Kevlar.
It is, Rob. And that's probably because, you know, Mother Nature has been at this for millions of years. Spiders have been evolving for a very long time. And those that don't make super strong webs are basically going to die because they're not going to be able to catch insects and they're not going to be able to eat to survive. Whereas human beings have only been working on creating tough materials like Kevlar for a few decades. So Mother Nature has got a very big head start on us. But we might be able to learn something from continuing to study these spiders.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from spiders spinning webs to the sun lobbing curveballs, this next story is about something called coronal mass ejections.
They come out curving like a curveball?
Well, they can. These ejections are these electrically charged, extremely hot eruptions from the sun's surface that explode from various parts of the sun. They can explode from the middle, what's called the equatorial plane, or near the northern latitudes or the southern latitudes of the sun. And researchers have been paying a lot of attention to these because these ejections can cause havoc here on Earth. They can disrupt GPS satellites, cell phone signals. They can even disrupt power grids and cause power outages. So this is something we're really concerned about. But in the past, what we've really focused on is the ejections that come more from the sun's equatorial plane, because that's the same plane that Earth is on. And scientists had long assumed that if there was an ejection coming from the quote-unquote top or bottom of the sun, those would just sort of go off into space and they weren't going to be a problem for us. But in this new study, scientists used NASA's twin stereo spacecrafts. And these are crafts that are monitoring these coronal mass ejections. And what they saw by analyzing some of these recordings was that even these ejections that come from the top or the bottom of the sun don't necessarily always dissipate out into space. Sometimes they, like a great curveball from a pitcher in the game of baseball, sometimes they turn in a much different direction than expected, and they can actually turn back towards the sun's equatorial plane, and therefore these ejections that we had been ignoring for so long could actually cause a lot of problems.
So something more for space weather forecasters to be on the lookout for.
Exactly. One more thing we have to worry about, unfortunately. But the good news here is that the researchers also showed that we can really monitor these ejections very well with these stereo spacecraft. So even though we have something extra to worry about that we didn't think we had to worry about, we also have a much better way of monitoring this solar activity than we did before. So hopefully we'll have a better way of forecasting these ejections and figuring out just how much damage they're going to do here on Earth.
Is there any way to mitigate that damage, say, if we find out with a few minutes warning that one of these is coming?
Well, yes. These things can cause over $1 trillion worth of damage and cause problems that could take 10 years to repair. One of the things researchers can do if they know one of these ejections is really going to have an impact on Earth is they can take the satellites and put them in what they call safe mode that would protect the satellite from damage or prevent a loss in GPS or other types of satellite communications. And as to the damage here on Earth, it's hard to know.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, getting back down to Earth, this last story is about earthquakes and what role dust plays in making them happen.
Dust is involved?
Well, it is involved. And actually, geologists don't call it dust. They call it fault gouge. And basically what this is, if you can imagine two plates sort of rubbing against each other, it's going to create dust, just as if you were to rub two rocks together really hard. And researchers already knew that this dust or fault gouge could help power earthquakes. And the reason is because there's a lot of friction involved. And actually this dust has a coating of water around it. And having that dust around actually helps the plates slip past each other a lot easier. And if you have a plate slip past another one very quickly, or relatively quickly, that's essentially what happens when you have at least one type of earthquake.
So what is it about this dust that powers the earthquake?
Well, Rob, here's essentially what happens. And the way the researchers found this out was they actually took these 5 centimeter tall granite plugs and essentially created almost like an earthquake fault in the lab with these two guys pressed very hard against each other. And what they found is initially what happens is when these plugs start moving against each other, it creates this fault gouge, this dust that we talked about. And that acts as a bit of a lubricant because this dust has a coating of water on it and it causes these plugs to start moving faster against each other. But then you get so much friction and so much heat that this water on the dust evaporates. And now all of a sudden you've got much more friction than you had before. And these plugs, or in the real world, these plates, stop moving as fast against each other. And that theoretically should stop the earthquake. But the problem is you've already built up so much pressure and heat at that point that eventually the pressure becomes too much. And these guys essentially break. In other words, they start moving much faster against each other. And that results in what in the real world would be an earthquake, which researchers have defined as these plates moving against each other at a speed of about 1 meter a second.
And the researchers were able to create this level of pressure that's equivalent to two plates under the earth in the lab?
Well, they were, or at least they tried, Rob, but they did it on a much smaller scale. And that's actually one of the criticisms of the study is that these conditions in the lab don't exactly replicate what you would see in the real world. So it's a little hard to draw concrete conclusions about just how applicable these findings are to real world earthquakes. But at least thanks to this experiment, we're learning a little bit more about this mysterious dust that seems to play a much larger role in earthquakes than researchers had previously thought.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into on the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about hepatitis B in songbirds and also a story about underwater robots that resemble stingrays. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the government dipping into geoengineering research. And geoengineering is this idea of trying to create man-made strategies that would help cool the planet, everything from launching tiny mirrors into space to seeding the ocean with billions of tiny bubbles. And also a story about women in science. Women have really been making big gains in science in terms of the degrees they're attaining. But a new report says that when you get beyond the doctoral level, the ratio of women to men starts to drop. And this report is trying to figure out exactly why that happens. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.